Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome in to the Bet the Board podcast, powered by betonline.ag. And then there were four teams remaining, vying for the Lombardi Trophy as we enter championship weekend. I am your fearless leader, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, a man who hates going over the total more than anyone known to mankind, the one, the only Payne Insider.
It's tough to do it. It's tough to do it. I can't stand overs.
I mean, we knew the texts were going to come. It was just a question of when they came in regards, because you and I are on an island with this mentality, along with maybe some of the other sharp guys. We actually hate going over the total, where the recreational bettor hates rooting for punts.
Yeah, I much prefer winning the entire game until we don't, rather than being down the entire game just rooting for points. It was annoying too. There's a lot of opportunity there. I don't like to do this. I don't like to whine and complain like a little bitch because it was the wrong side. But it takes two teams, and neither team, they weren't scoring at the same times, and the game's really different. If Ted Ginn is hit for an opening touchdown, he's open by 4 yards. He's got his man beat. Ertz beats Lattimore by about 4 or 5 yards, and Foles underthrows him on that pick in the second half, the third quarter there. The long 11.5-minute drive is only a 5-minute drive if Breeze doesn't throw a wobbler to Taysom Hill. So, I mean, just little different things. Brandon Graham has the fumble if he falls on it. The Eagles have the ball at the 30 as opposed to turning the possession back over. And then you get a punt and a pin. So wrong side. It was a loser. It happens. I just, man, I hate overs. And I've been trying to adapt, right? Because I don't want to go the way of the dinosaur. We're in a scoring time right now. Points were up this season, over 46 points per game scored on average. So it's trending upwards. It's what's going on. We see these teams now all the time, Todd, right? We're not fully there. We're not fully acclimated into analytics. All the teams aren't using them. But we're starting to see that gradual transition. Like 2 years ago, teams were going for it on fourth down like 23% of the time. This year, it's up to 31%. We've seen an increase in scoring because of that, about 70 or 80 more touchdowns this season. These teams are willing to go for it more, and it's just going to continue to increase scoring. So I don't want to be a dinosaur, but man, do I hate going over.
Yeah, perfect illustration of teams being more aggressive. Sean McVay in the Rams-Cowboys game electing to score the touchdown from a yard out rather than kicking the field goal, and it slammed the back door shut in the face of some of the sharpest guys out there who are on the Cowboys plus a 7.5. Just small illustrations. And we talk about it, Payne. I think you bring up a great point. People look at the final scores or they see the numbers, but it's a play here, it's a play there, especially in a market as efficient as the NFL, that if one domino falls, it creates a little bit of a chain reaction. But we're not two guys to cry over spilled milk. It was a hell of a heater that we were on. We give one back, and we'll finish with a flourish with two big games on the docket. Of course, Dave Mason will join us later on. Curious to get his take how the weekend went for the house. Have to imagine with underdogs all losing outright, some of the liabilities there were neutralized. And they have to be in good shape for the futures market going forward. But one last thing.
You distracted me with real stuff, by the way. I was going to bust your nuts a little bit about this fearless thing. When did you become fearless?
I feel like it's more a joke than anything else. I mean, frankly scared of my own shadow when it comes to firing at college basketball Saturdays. Let's not mince words around here.
Oh, firing on college basketball Saturdays. Not usually how I operate. You know me. I prefer a smaller board. I'd rather
you're not the guy with the shotgun.
Larger positions.
You're not the shotgun guy spraying bullets, trying to college football Saturdays, trying to bet like 65 games, team totals, first half, second half. That's not your style in MO.
It's not. But the last two Saturdays in college basketball, we have had 47.
What are you guys approaching? Like 90 plays?
80 bets. 80 bets on the last two Saturdays. It's not fun. It's not fun.
I'm sure a lot of our listeners are going out there, man, that's some sweet action.
Not how we operate, but hey, we felt those games had an edge, and our college basketball season hasn't been flipping coins so far. Last year, we couldn't lose. Last year, it was like unbelievable. Couldn't lose. And we're starting to trend a little hotter right now the last couple of days, but oof. Yeah, 80 bets the last two Saturdays. And for me even, right, like manage my money, all about that. I couldn't even watch the games. I was like, hey, I'm actually going to go away today. I'm just going to check the scores at the end of the day. Like, this isn't anything I'm going to be able to deal with.
Yeah, and then it's 10:30 Pacific. You're sending me a text. Oh, buzzer beater here. Oh, fourth, collapse in the final minute. So you have a little fun with it. We know it's a business first and foremost, but there's definitely multiple ways to skin a cat. Hey, just real quick, Payne, before we get into the four teams that are remaining in the two games, which we're going to break down, obviously, in great detail, anything really surprise you for what you saw from the four games during the divisional weekend?
Man, I was a little surprised with the Saints' offensive execution. I don't want to get too far into that because we'll talk about the Saints, obviously. Against the Rams. But yeah, I didn't love the initial game plan there. It appeared that there was some rust, right? And that's kind of always the debate when you're sitting there saying, hey, do we rest our guys in week 17 for this meaningless game? A lot of teams choose not to, right? A lot of teams say, hey, let's build up a little bit of a lather, have them go through the weekly motions and then take them out after a series or two. I kind of like that approach, right? Get them mentally focused to do the things throughout the course of the week 17, week, and then have them lead up to the game, get a little lather before play a possession or two, and then get them out. But when you had the Saints basically take off 22 days, was the time from the week 16 game after week 17, after their bye, and then into last week. 22 days seemed to be a little too much early on. I didn't love what they were doing with Kamara early in that game either.
Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting when you go through the rest versus rust discussion and debate that a lot of these teams do when they're able to secure home field advantage, especially throughout the playoffs, and how they elect to approach, whether it's week 16 in some cases, or obviously much more frequently in week 17, which I guess leads you to the perfect segue then for the Saints, who are, of course, playing host to the Rams in the early game on Sunday. You're looking at the Saints, a 3-point favorite at betonline.ag. You do have to lay $1.20 on the chalk. Total in this game, 56, Payne, down a shade from where it opened. And instead of talking about the actual players on the field, I wanted to get your take on this coaching matchup. Sean Payton, the accomplished head coach, he's put together a long history of renegade decision-making before it was in vogue, and Sean McVay more or less ushering in that next generation of elite head coaches.
I see what you did there. Was that like a semi-shot at the whole Greg Williams situation?
I mean, I took my shots last week, and they weren't so veiled. I said
Sean Payton came out of that puppy looking clean. I mean, that was... He sure did, the fall guy there.
And so did Greg Williams, who now will have his place as a defensive coordinator full-time this season.
How nuts is that going to be? That Adam Gase and Greg Williams. All right. Coaching. Listen, like, both these guys are elite, McVay and Payton. You know, I doubt we're going to see a scenario like last week. And if you have been following things closely this week, the Rams basically talked about after last week's game, like, hey, we knew what Dallas was doing 90% of the time. As like literally, you know, John Sullivan and Austin Blythe came out and were like, hey, based on alignment, we knew what the Cowboys defensive line was going to do. We knew what stunt was coming based on how wide their stances were and which linemen had their hands down for Dallas. Like, that tipped off our offensive line, and we knew which direction they were going to be attacking from. We're not going to see a situation like that in this week, I don't think, because Payton and McVay are both elite. I don't know if there's a massive coaching mismatch. They were pretty even in the first go round, so I don't think there's anything here there. Right, the team that executes the best is going to win this game.
Two teams, of course, both top five in offensive efficiency. The Rams check in at number two, Saints number four. A little bit of a disparity on the defensive side, where the Saints have been, I don't want to call it significantly better because it's the full body of work, and I know you
no,
are the
significantly
king.
Better.
Okay, but I was going to ask you, though, season body of work, that's fine, but in terms of the way they've trended, I mean, some of the numbers, you look at how the Rams have performed once they got Aqib Talib back in the fold, and you talk about current form and trend lines being more indicative of what to expect week to week than if you look at everything that they've accomplished. Have you seen the market improvements from the Rams with Talib out there as far as scheme and their ability to put some of those corners on an island, let Peters and Talib do their thing, and sell out to stop the run like they seem to do pretty effectively against the Cowboys?
So we touched on this a little bit last week about the Rams' defensive improvements and really after their bye, the shift that they made, and they were top six in both rushing and defensive, rushing and passing defensive success rate after their bye week. So that was pretty big. I think there was also a little bit of a schematic change when it came to Wade Phillips. He was going more zone in the back end. So I think that's going to be something to monitor here a little bit as well. When I was watching that game last week, and the Rams did a great job, you could tell, and I texted you that I got a note that this was going to be the game plan, that they were going to throw Joyner down in the box, but they were selling out, loading the box to stop the Cowboys' run game last week, but they didn't get after the quarterback at all. That was the big thing to me. And, you know, they really stifled the ground game. They made Dak beat him, which I think was the perfect recipe. And he made a couple good throws, made a couple bad throws, didn't do enough, bottom line, to win the game. But they didn't get after Dak at all. And I think that's going to have to change here. He was only pressured on 15% of his dropbacks. And I think if you're going into New Orleans and you're going to give Breeze a clean pocket, you're going to get torched. It's going to be a long day. So I think that's the key here in this game. Donald or Sue, whoever is lined up over Andres Pete has to win that matchup like all day long. You have to create that interior pressure where Breeze hates it most. You know, Pete right now, and I was kind of bashing a little bit as I was watching the game. I was like, you know, the city Philly boys are really beating up on the Stanford guy out west. But then afterwards, you know, it comes out that he's been playing with basically a broken wrist and hand and all that stuff. So he is playing through a significant hand injury. He gave up two pressures last week. He was whistled for four penalties. So, like, Donald and Sue are going to have to win that matchup. You got to get Breeze off his spot. He's 5'11", 5'10", right? He has trouble throwing over that. So if you can get him to shift left or right, it really helps the secondary out. That's going to be, I think, the key thing here for that Rams defense. I'm intrigued a little bit to see what happens with the Rams corners. Right, because Tlaib is the more physical corner. He hasn't traveled a lot this season. He likes being on the right side of the field. He likes looking into the quarterback's eyes. I want to see if he travels with Michael Thomas. If he doesn't, I think Peters can get abused again a little bit. The other thing, and it was a little bit, I think, based on how the game unfolded, and then I went back and looked, and really, the Rams cut it to a one-score game with a lot of time left. But whatever Wade Phillips did at halftime, he made some good adjustments, I thought, in that first game. And it kind of allowed the Rams to inch their way back. But Kamara torched them in the first half of that game. I'm not sure what week it was, but obviously the game they played earlier this season. Kamara had 13 touches in the first half for 84 yards and three touchdowns. Second half, he had 10 touches for 32 yards. So there was a clear adjustment there on how they went to defend Kamara, and I think that'll be big. We'll see if they introduce that from the onset here. But I think that's what we can expect from the Rams defense.
When you look at some of the other ways the Saints may elect to attack, we know that Michael Thomas, I mean, he was absolutely massive in the win against the Eagles. Ted Ginn, who we talked about at great lengths, only had three catches but was targeted seven times in that game. I mean, is it the kind of thing when you try and go through the Saints' thought process, is Kamara more valuable as a runner between the tackles in this kind of matchup, or do you split him out wide and maybe allow Mark Ingram, given some of the issues that you mentioned on the offensive line, that the Saints will most likely struggle to run to the left side?
You know, listen, for the Saints' offensive, I just think the game plan needs to be better. I think Drew Brees needs to be better. And I talked about this a little bit at the top, like, maybe it was the 22 days off between the starts. It created a little bit of rust. Breeze missed a lot of throws, and we outlined them. You had the one to Ted Ginn on the underthrow. You had the underthrow to Taysom Hill. I think there was another opportunity when I was looking at some of the coaches' film. They did pick up a first down to Michael Thomas for like 20 yards on a third down, but Ted Ginn is wide open deep, and he just chooses not to throw it there. The Saints never looked like they really got in rhythm. Breeze wasn't like getting the ball out quick like I thought they were going to do, right? You think we got injuries on the offensive line. We're facing a Philly defensive front that's very good. They're deciding to play zone in the back. Let's get to this quick passing game where the pass rush can't get to us and we can throw underneath and, you know, through the zone. We know how accurate Breeze is. But he wasn't getting the ball out quick. 2.6 seconds, which is below the league average. It oddly looked like it was by design. It was really weird. And then, you know, Kamara wasn't touching the ball in the first half. He only had six touches. Second half, he touched the ball much more. And there was no reason, right? He had 8.2 yards per touch in the first half. You even had Sean Payton come out when he was interviewed at halftime, like, listen, we need to get Kamara the ball a little bit more. I'm not sure what happened there. So I think more of the short passing game needs to be employed, especially with the Rams now playing a little bit more zone defense after the bye. I think Ted Ginn, again, is the X factor here. I was looking at snap counts. Keith Kirkwood outsnapped them by just a little bit, but I just think Ted Ginn is so dynamic here. So I think that's going to be interesting. Let's see what Ted Ginn can do this week. He was open a lot last week. I know, as you alluded to, the stats didn't indicate he had this big game. He was open a lot.
Oh, I bet that
I think
over,
there's going to be some of those same opportunities here.
Bet him over 48 and a half yards receiving and couldn't even get there. I was not too happy about the way that whole scenario played out. I ain't going to lie.
I ain't going to lie to you, boys.
So, yeah, when you look at all that, it'd be interesting. Like you said, the different weapons and the ways the Saints will elect to attack this Rams team. Now, on the other side of the ball, Payne, I think this for me is a little bit more fascinating, to be honest. We try and figure out Jared Goff and what the Rams are going to do. Over the last couple weeks, this team has really become a ground-and-pound entity, averaging 232 yards per game since Week 16. They've had 90 rushing attempts the last 2 weeks. We've seen C.J. Anderson lighten a little bit of the workload for Todd Gurley. He actually leads the league in rushing since Week 16, 422 yards and a bunch of rushing touchdowns. First player in league history to do 100 yards and a touchdown in each of his first three games with a new team. Even more impressive for a dude who looks like he hadn't said no at the Golden Corral line at the same time.
Leave it to a skinny guy to make fun of fat guys.
Dude, C.J. Anderson, C.J. Anderson 2019 looks like he swallowed C.J. Anderson in 2017.
You've done your studying, by the way. You've noticed this offensive shift from the Rams. You were at the coffee shop last night.
I was.
You conveniently left at the wrong time.
There's a lot of magic. Yeah, I don't want to talk about that. You have to dredge up a painful hoops memory? I thought we were done with the hoops portion of the show.
Our listeners should absolutely tweet at us. For me, and I guess I'm a little superstitious, if things are going well in the location I'm currently watching game, like, I'm not adjusting. Last night, and just for listeners, we had Boston College in the first half plus 6.5. They're up 12 with 6 minutes to go, catching 6.5. Louisville goes on a 27-5 run to end the half. And I find out Todd decided to up and leave after they're up 28-16, completely changed the juju.
Well, hold on a second here. That's not the whole story. So they were up 28-16, but Boston College had started to whittle away some of their lead. I think it was 32-25 or thereabouts. And at that point, I said, all right, I got to change things up a little bit. I leave, I revisit the score 40 minutes later, and I'm absolutely stunned to find out that they go into the breakdown 43-33, and we can't cover the damn bet.
So you made the wrong decision.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, story of my life. Story of my life, making the wrong decision. So Jared Goff, we look at Goff, last six games, 221 yards passing, six touchdowns, six interceptions, a passer rating of 74. He's also thrown the ball less than 30 times in the last three games. However, that's coincided with his ability to protect the football, something that plagued him late in the season. What do we make of this new look Rams offense, and do we think we see more of the same this week, knowing that the Saints lose Sheldon Rankins on their defensive line, who was second on the team in tackles for loss with 12.
One thing's clear, and I've hinted at it for a few years now. Every time I talk Rams offense, and people recall, I mentioned McVay's brilliance. Rarely do I comment about Goff. And, you know, let's call a spade here. There's not a quarterback in the NFL being propped up more by coaching and his scheme than Jared Goff. And, you know, like at this point in the season, when you probably should be relying on your quarterback more, McVay and the Rams offense has gone the complete opposite direction. And you hit on this, right? Like, literally, McVay is telling us he is willing to use an overweight guy claimed off the street a few weeks ago rather than rely on his quarterback more when the games mean the most. And I think McVay came to this realization that in big games against top tier competition, he couldn't really rely on Goff as much as he hoped, right? You go back in you know, a couple of weeks towards the end of the season, big game against the Eagles, good defense, a defensive front, big game against the Bears. Goff struggled in both those games. So they lose back to back games. The Rams went 76% pass in those two games. And I know a lot of people will come out and be like, well, they trailed in those games, so you should expect more pass. But the reality is, I looked at the game plan. It was a pass-heavy game plan in the first halves of those Eagles-Bears games. Goff threw it on 73% of the snaps. And I think it's important to bring up because it's clear, as you mentioned, this Rams offense has completely changed. The last three games, they've mattered the most, right? They're playing for the bye week. It's a playoff game as well against Dallas. And then you take it one step further and you know McVay is sharp as hell. He's looking at the game film and saying, hey, I'm looking at Dallas and they're very good against the run. They're not very good against the pass. And yet, the last 3 weeks, they're 62% run in the most important games. And it's just this dramatic, drastic shift. You mentioned Sheldon Rankins. He's out. It's a big loss, I think, for the interior of the Saints defense. It puts more pressure, I think, on guys like David Onyemata. He's got to play big. And I think this is interesting. Like, there's a rookie. His name's Taylor Stallworth. He's actually done very well stopping the run. So that's going to be the key thing to watch here. When I looked at all these guys and how they were against the run, there's actually not a huge drop-off stopping the run. Where this drop-off really comes is getting pressure on the quarterback. Rankins has done very well getting after the quarterback from the interior, and that's I think, where we see this substantial drop-off, and I think that's beneficial to Goff because we've kind of outlined this, right? Complete 73% of his passes when he's got a clean pocket, 43% when under pressure. If there's a lack of interior pressure from the Saints, I think that could certainly play a role. The other interesting thing here, if you look at trend lines, as good as the Saints' run defense has been, it's top 10 this season in rushing success rate full season. Since week 13, they're actually bottom third in the league, and they faced the seventh easiest schedule of run offenses. So there has been a little bit of a dip with the Saints' defense stopping the run. It's really all about Goff. It really is. If the Rams can't run the ball, I think it's going to be really tough to win this game based on what I have seen from Jared Goff. I think if you're going to take anything away from last week's podcast, I think one of them has to be the home away splits for both these quarterbacks in this game. And both Breeze and Goff have some of the most exaggerated splits in the NFL, and now Goff hits the road where he kind of morphs from a good quarterback at home to a below average quarterback on the road. Even last week, right? You look at home, a game where his offensive line absolutely dominated, right? Like, they were creating massive holes for the run game. You look at their pass protection. Goff was hit once on his 30 dropbacks. Goff missed a lot of throws last week. He was anticipating pressure well before it was coming. You look at that opening drive and it was like, man, this could be ugly for the Rams offense because they get 3 points out of it. But like two or three plays on that series, Goff is like airmailing throws because he's treating the ball like a hot potato. Like, he's trying to get rid of it before pressure is like even close to getting there. His footwork was bad. He wasn't aligned properly. It was really weird. I do think McVay is going to put Goff in a better position to succeed than Doug Peterson did Nick Foles last week. I thought Doug Peterson after those initial drives was really poor. They got really conservative, the Eagles. If you looked at the first few drives, they were snapping the ball with 10, 12, 15 seconds left on the play clock. Once it got tight, I mean, there's a couple delay of games. They're snapping it with under 5 seconds. The other thing that I think the Eagles didn't do very well was once Dennis Allen made a switch and had Marshawn Lattimore shatter Alshon Jeffrey, they weren't doing anything outside. But the Eagles only threw to the middle of the field 12% of the time. So I think McVay is smart enough now to at least give Goff a better chance at being successful. Use the entire field. So, you know, he's got McVay, so I think Goff has a chance here. But if they can't run the ball, I don't know if Goff's going to be able to win this game just throwing it.
No, I mean, this is a Rams team that we talk about as a high-flying offense, but their success starts and stops with the ground attack. And while it's not quite the same, so I hate to even make this comparison, but I'll do it anyways. I mean, you look at Oregon and what Chip Kelly was even able to do. Everyone goes, oh, this is an offense that hits you in space. Well, Chip Kelly's offense has only ran when the running game got going. It wasn't a passing attack. They used the run to set up the pass, and it's not an air raid or anything close to that. And I think the Rams show some of those tendencies in that regard. When I look, lastly, Payne, at the venue for this game, you mentioned the home road splits for the two quarterbacks. Home field advantage here. How big a factor do you make the Superdome? We talk about, or I shouldn't say we do, mainstream media is under the mindset and misconception that every home field is 3 points, and that's what's built into it. These teams are equal, and we can continue the narrative. What kind of adjustment do you make for home field here in the Superdome in a game of this magnitude?
Well, I do think there's a little bit of an advantage, or you would think, right, having with the Rams already having played there this season. They know the environment. They've dealt with it before. They know what they need to do and change, you know, with their signals, how they need to prep for that. Home field advantage is dramatic here. You know, you're looking at least 3.5 points. Some guys make it 4, which kind of tells you a little bit about this line. Which I think is pretty intriguing. I don't want to go too far into detail, but you know, the line is odd to me in this game. I'm really having a tough time with both these games this week. Don't love anything, but this line really caught me off guard based upon home field advantage. It really insinuates that the Rams are a better team, and I don't know if that's been the case for, I don't know, 4 to 6 weeks now.
Yeah, it's not like this is the Rams team we saw early in the season when they were putting up points and doing so in bunches, looking like a reincarnation of the greatest show on turf. All right, from the early game that's going to be played in nice climate-controlled conditions of the Superdome to the Arctic Blast at Arrowhead.
You did, man.
What's up?
Yeah, continue.
Where Kansas City is a 3-point home favorite as they'll play host to the first ever conference championship game at Arrowhead. Total on this game sits at 56 at betonline.ag as the Patriots come in. If we put some of these numbers into a better historical context, first time since week 2 of the 2015 season, the Pats will enter the game as an underdog with Tom Brady as their starting quarterback. It'll end a streak of 67 straight contests, and they'll be a playoff underdog for the first time since 2013, a conference championship game against the Denver Broncos, one where the Patriots came up on the wrong side of the stick. Payne, we talked about home road splits for Goff and Breeze. They're extremely pronounced with Belichick and Brady. What for you is the first thing that you look to try and handicap this particular matchup as the Chiefs and Patriots will match wits for the second time this season?
Not the Arctic Blast. Like, oh.
Six God. Degrees, bro.
You transferred into to TV Todd on this podcast. I don't want to hear the words Arctic Blast ever again. That's like something you get free with, like, you know, $20 on pump 7 at your local gas station. Like, it's a marketing ploy to sell the games because you have nothing to talk about for 10 hours of pregame coverage on game day. It's fun to show people like beating their seats with rubber hoses. Listen, reality is, and we can get this weather shit out of the way here now. Temperature is rising the closer we get to kickoff. It's supposed to be 22 degrees at kick as I look right now Thursday morning. Right, there's no precipitation. The wind is actually lower than the league average. They're projecting like 7 mile per hour winds here. Everyone that like has a database has come to like this isn't going to be like a revelation, right? You have a database, you can look at this stuff. Last 19 seasons when the temperature is below 30, if you blindly bet the over, you would have cashed like nearly 56% of the time.
Yeah, right?
It's
per game
well
those...
over a 20-game sample.
True.
I don't think... You get into like this weird thing, and I get that it's fun to look at these trends, but like you get into this like weird thing of like, oh, I'm going to gauge temperature at 0 degrees and then 5 degrees and then 10 degrees and then 30 degrees. And you get into like these trends where it's like, you know, on a Tuesday night with a full moon kind of thing, like cold is cold.
Blood moon,
and
baby.
It's going to be 22 degrees is what they're projecting now. They were projecting 5 at the beginning of the week. Again, temperature's rising a little bit, but you get these two teams. They've played in this weather. They practice in this weather. They talked about it last week. Like, New England hasn't practiced indoors in like ages. I think they're used to this kind of weather. I think the bigger thing is more about, and one thing with the weather, and I surface seems to be like the biggest thing. That might be the factor that plays a role in this game. In the first matchup you had, Kansas City, they're playing at Gillette. It's carpet. They have a speed advantage. Maybe on this surface, they don't have that speed advantage. The one thing, though, that I looked into a little bit when it comes to weather and the coldness, teams are actually far more efficient running the ball. It was interesting to see that, and I think it would just be because guys don't want to tackle as much. It's harder to tackle. But running efficiency has been up when the temperatures are frigid. Passing does decrease a little bit, to be fair. So that's the gist of the weather. Like, I don't want to, I get it. It's fun to see snow games and it's fun to market and promote that, but I don't know if that's going to be the determining factor of this game on who wins it because it's 22 degrees out. I don't think that to be the case.
Well, you talk about run games, and we've talked at great lengths all season long about Kansas City and some of their trials and tribulations against opposing ground attacks. Meanwhile, in New England, they stayed committed to Sony Michel, and he rewarded them quite handsomely last weekend against the Chargers. Michel had a pretty big day in the first meeting between these two teams. How does Kansas City defensively match up with the New England offense if they want to stay committed to ground and pound, whether it's with Michel, whether it's James White, Rex Burkhead, you name him?
They don't. They don't. You know, listen, if the Patriots like go on the road to Arrowhead and come out with a win, I think it's because their offensive line dominates. I really believe that's the case. Tom Brady has been good down the stretch. And I thought he was fantastic last week. He brought in his personal passing coach during the bye week to kind of get him back in perfect throwing form to fix his mechanics that weren't spot on. And it worked. You know, I don't think Gus Bradley had the best game plan.
What?
But
you mean
Brady? But if you watch Brady, he was extremely accurate. He was mobile within the pocket. He got the ball out on time. His accuracy was superb. It really looked like the passing coach worked on some things during the bye week. What were you going to say now about...
No, I was going to say it looked
Gus Bradley had a bad game plan.
Yeah, Gus Bradley looked like he was taking pages out of the Mike Tomlin playbook there to try and defend the Patriots receivers in space.
Everybody was giving him the old pat on the back the week before for just putting his best players out in the field. Suddenly that changed. It's like, who won all these defensive backs? Yeah, it wasn't like a linebacker on the roster, bro. Anyways, when I looked at this, Brady's obviously going to play a role. But I think the offensive line is the key here. I think if you can keep Brady clean, that's going to be big. If you can kind of enforce your will in the run game, that's big. We know Dante Scarnecchia is one of the best to ever coach the offensive line position. Right now, the Patriots are humming up front. And last week, you look, Brady was pressured on 13% of his 46 dropbacks, wasn't sacked, only hit once. I think, and we've mentioned this a little bit about the Patriots ground attack. And I think you believe, like, you know, Brady, Belichick, and you think efficient offense and where football's trending, and it's like lots of passing. That comes to mind. And certainly, historically, we've seen in the playoffs, Belichick relies on Brady's arm far more. But when New England elects to run the ball, they take that old school style. They take that old school approach. They run from 21 personnel with a big fullback leading the way more than anyone in the NFL. And if you start to dig into some of these numbers a little bit, the Chiefs have been susceptible to any running play, but they are extremely susceptible to that personnel grouping, 21 with a fullback. You look at the week 6 matchup at Gillette Stadium, the Patriots ran it actually more than they passed, which I think is stunning when you look that they hung 43 points and they ran it more than they passed. But New England was successful on 68% of their runs, had 7 explosives. Certainly that's right. That's tough to replicate. You know, there's only one direction from those kind of numbers, but I still think they have success. Like, the Chiefs aren't changing who they are. They have the 2 worst starting linebacker combinations in the NFL. Like, in the offseason, they got to go out and get 2 new starters, whether it's via the draft or free agency. The linebackers are terrible. They don't trigger quick. They don't play downhill. They can't cover tight ends. So I think they're going to have some issues stopping the run here, obviously. I think when you look at being able to run the ball, what comes off that? A little bit of play action. I don't know if Gronk is himself. I think that's clearly obvious he's not. And they used him in blocking more last week than they did in running routes. But I think still, right, on like crucial key third downs or in, you know, the red zone a little bit, Gronk can still be a factor here. And if you can run it, the play action is going to really give you some opportunities against Kansas City's defense. They've given up 10 touchdowns to tight ends, the 3rd most yards to tight ends. So Gronk, despite not being himself, despite being, you know, he's got a back injury and it is going to be cold, that might be the one player that the cold really impacts him. But I still think he can have some clutch catches. James White, we talked a little bit about last week. He had 15 catches. I was a little surprised he had that many. But again, come playoff time, they like to pass the ball short. I was happy to see, and it They gave the ball to the guys who needed to get the ball, right? They were running with Sony Michel. They were passing to James White. Burkhead did get the touchdown, but he just wasn't involved as much, which I think is a positive. And the Chiefs are terrible defending running back passes again. They've given up a league high 6 touchdowns to backs. Fifth worst in receiving yards allowed to backs. So I think New England's got some advantages here on offense. I really do.
James White becomes, I mean, you look at the Patriots' weapons, we know they're a little bit thin at receiver. I mean, Julian Edelman leads that bunch. I mean, Chris Hogan is what he is. James White, Sony Michel. So if you're devising the game plan for the Patriots, quick passing game, neutralize Kansas City's pass rush, try and run the football effectively. One thing about that first meeting, I mean, Justin Houston didn't play. Does he change anything that Kansas City can do defensively?
Yeah, obviously you want Justin Houston out in the field, but he's not as good if he's not able to get pressure on the quarterback, if it's not in these known passing situations. That was the one thing where we really saw the Chiefs defense do work last week against the Colts. And I think we've talked about this ad nauseum, right? The Chiefs defense isn't good down to down if they don't know what you're doing. But if the Chiefs can get you in a known passing situation, their defense is pretty good because they have three elite pass rushers, right? D Ford's electric from the end. You have Houston, who's electric from the end, and Chris Jones, who's like the most underappreciated player in the NFL. Cannot believe he didn't make the Pro Bowl. Maybe he does with guys sitting out eventually. I don't know that whole situation, but he is an elite pass rusher from the interior as well. And your back half, and it's not the greatest secondary, but they're certainly better in pass defense than they are stopping the run. So the key here is, and you'll notice it, if New England can win on early downs and make it so it's not obvious passing situations, New England's going to be able to move the ball here at will. If you get in these second and long and third and long where you're forced to pass, the Chiefs defense is going to have a little more success.
The other side of the ball, headliner there, of course, Patrick Mahomes, the youngest quarterback to win a playoff game since Mark Sanchez did it way back in 2009. You look at what this Chiefs
was against New England?
The first game he won, I believe he beat Peyton Manning, and then he beat New England, okay. Right?
I know New England lost to the Jets.
It was definitely that year. I think Sanchez went on the road, beat Peyton Manning, goes on the road the following week, beats Brady, and that means they would have lost to the Steelers in the AFC Championship.
I'm not good with the history stuff. I know he beat New England in the playoffs one time.
Yeah,
it was really odd.
I think that was a sequence of quarterbacks and how it all played out there. But the Chiefs averaged 32.3 points per game, at home. We know how explosive this offense is, 30-plus points in 13 of 17 games. And we look at Bill Belichick career-wise, he's allowed 40-plus points 7 times in his career. Andy Reid accounts for 3 of those outings since he took over in Kansas City. What is the matchup you're most intrigued by as far as the Chiefs' offense against a Patriots defense that we know loves to employ that bend-but-don't-break mentality?
I think it's the same thing. I think it's running. I know we're in a pass-happy league, but the way the Patriots disguise things in the back end, and listen, the Chiefs could have won that game. They battled back. I believe they were down 24-9 at halftime in the first meeting. But you can still confuse Patty Mahomes a little bit, right? There's situations where if you look at how he passes the ball, if he releases it in 2.5 seconds or less, he's very efficient. When he holds on to the ball just a little bit more, certainly he can create some highlight reel plays, but he's just not as efficient. So, and you can still confuse him a little bit. He's a young kid. This is going to be the biggest game of his life. And we know that's what the Patriots do. They confuse quarterbacks. So maybe you see that situation, but I think the big thing here is Damian Williams being able to establish the ground game. I think that's huge. And we kind of pounded the table, if you remember, after the Oakland game and said, hey, Damian Williams is just way more efficient than Spencer Ware. And Williams needs to get the majority of the carries. And, you know, it didn't take Andy Reid long. And I think injuries kind of helped force his hand there a little bit. But it's come to reality now. We've seen it unfold, right? And I think you can expect some of the same stuff. I think you see Damian Williams. Think he's going to have a good game here. The Patriots have struggled to stop the run, especially the way the Chiefs run the ball. And if you make note of that, like the Kansas City, like routinely runs from 11 personnel in the shotgun. If you look, roughly 2/3 of all their running plays that KC does, they come from that formation, one tight end, one running back, 3 wide receivers from the shotgun. New England has been one of the league's worst teams stopping the run from that formation. If you look at the first matchup, and I don't think it was a surprise, right? You know what Andy Reid does. You have the film. This is what he likes to do. They could not stop the run in week 6 at Gillette. The Chiefs ran for 5.5 a carry. 71% of their runs graded successful. let's see, and this is, I'm trying to pose this nicely for the Patriots fans. Maybe Danny Shelton can help a little bit. Now, he's been out of the doghouse the last 3 weeks. He's helped improve that run defense of the Patriots. We outlined that a little bit last week. Again, in week 16 and 17, the Patriots have only allowed 39% of runs to grade successful. Again, last week, Chargers 19 rushing yards on 10 carries. What was interesting, though, if you're a Chiefs fan, you'll be using this data. I went back and looked. Week 6, Danny Shelton did play, played 61% of the snaps, so he wasn't a factor in that game. The Chiefs ran wild from that formation, and I think that is going to be the key. If you're watching this at home, when you look at this formation of the Chiefs in the shotgun with Damian Williams, and they got three wide receivers, one tight end out there, if they can run from that formation, they're going to have a lot of success offensively. If the Patriots can somehow stop runs from that formation, then the Chiefs are going to struggle a little bit offensively.
Well, you mentioned that week six matchup, excuse me, and there's one key contributor for the Chiefs offense who obviously, as we all know, is no longer on the roster. He being Kareem Hunt, who's burned the Patriots for 431 total yards from scrimmage and four touchdowns in two previous matchups against New England. Can Damian Williams replicate what Kareem Hunt did in those previous meetings?
You would hope, and he's certainly not the talent of Kareem Hunt. He certainly doesn't have the massive playability. You know, Kareem Hunt, you know, speaking from a football perspective, is a really good player. And I wasn't as high on him coming out of the draft as most people were, but he did a really good job changing his body a little bit, shed some pounds, added some muscle, didn't lose his quickness or explosiveness. It actually increased the more muscle he added to his body. So I was shocked at how much of an impact he initially had. And he's torched this New England defense, as you alluded to. But if you are just like a stat monkey, this is pretty wild. Kareem Hunt has been successful on 54% of his runs this season. Damian Williams, 65%. So in the running game, where there's not as much explosiveness, but down to down, they really have not missed Kareem Hunt, which is pretty shocking. And I think this is probably reason 742. On why drafting a running back at the top of the draft is a little bit dicey. Saquon Barkley's fantastic, but oof, it's tough to make that kind of investment when you're plucking guys like Damian Williams who's making $1 million this year, and he's having, you know, similar success, if not better, in a lot of key categories.
When we look at the other weapons on this Chiefs offense, we know New England does things defensively as well as anybody, and they always predicate a lot of their success on taking away your primary weapon. If you're New England, do you try and neutralize Kelce, or do you try and eliminate Tyreek Hill and the explosive big play potential he has from the game plan? Easier, of course, said than done.
Yeah, absolutely. And Tyreek Hill is a matchup nightmare, and we've kind of talked about the limitations that New England has defensively with their team speed. So he becomes a problem, and I think it's huge, right? This is the kind of game where Sammy Watkins really has a massive impact, because he's still good enough to win that one-on-one battle. We saw him get acclimated back into the game plan against the Colts last week. I thought he was very efficient. That big catch early on in the game, I thought it was a great sign, right? There's a lot of stop and start, which, you know, if your foot wasn't 100% healthy, you wouldn't have saw that. So I think it's beneficial that he's back. If you are going to do something where you try to remove Tyreek Hill from the game, at least you have Sammy Watkins. At least you have Travis Kelce. It's really difficult, especially if Kansas City is able to establish the ground game with Damian Williams, to stop this offense because they have so many weapons. And the other thing here is Andy Reid. The guy is brilliant. I know he's fallen short. I know his in-game clock management, his in-game decisions to call timeouts, some of that stuff leaves a lot to be desired. But when it comes to just the X's and O's, devising a game plan, coming up with a script, usually that stuff is spot on. And since 2014, Andy Reid is 14-3 in same-season rematches. One of those losses did come earlier in the year on a short week, Thursday night, after they blew a 2-score lead to the Chargers. But he has been nails in rematches, and it's because he can go back to the film, figure out and self-scout what they didn't do well enough, what they didn't exploit enough against their opponent. And I just think when you face someone for a second time, or you face someone multiple times, it's all about the adjustments. And I think Andy Reid's going to have some things up his sleeve here to be pretty successful offensively.
When we look at the number in total, anything surprise you about either of those two figures?
So the initial open at one shop on the total was 60.5. And I don't really want to mention the company, but while they're not as sharp opening numbers as they once were, you know, they're not bumbling idiots, you know, and it just kind of, it kind of tells you what they thought about this game. And I think there was a lot of initial talk, and you're right, you're spot on. Like on Monday, when you were looking at the weather forecast and everyone's talking Arctic, whatever the hell they're calling, was it Arctic Blast?
Arctic Blast. It's soon to Arctic be, Blast. Soon it's, to be it's a new the blue flavor of Mountain Dew as
the,
well.
Yeah. It's the blue flavored drink that you get at the gas station. So when they were talking about that, you saw this total continue to tick down. Once it got to 54, there was, I can tell you another group that that hit it. Now, man, I feel like I'm always bashing people. This specific group just doesn't have the best sense for market timing. I think we could have probably got this a little bit lower as people all over television talk Arctic Blast for the next 3-4 days. And you could have had potential to go over 52. I don't think that's going to be the case now. So there is a battle on this total where initially there was under money. And then at 54, there was some very sharp over money. And the guy who's originating that has been red hot of late. And what was shocking, again, when I went back and watched that first matchup, Todd, seeing that the Patriots ran it more than they passed it and still hung 43, you know, potentially that stylistic matchup of saying, hey, the Patriots are just going to be ground and pound here and they're going to chew the clock. Like, they kind of did that in the first matchup. It just didn't matter. There are just that many offensive advantages. I certainly couldn't go under this game. I just couldn't. And I think when I looked at my key core number on this total, it was 56.5. So, you know, there's not a lot of value. These numbers right now are pretty damn tight, I got to tell you.
Yeah, doesn't appear to be a whole heck of a lot for either of these two football games. So, you know, we'll get to some of the other topics at hand. But before we do that, let's go to a man behind the counter. He joins us every Thursday here on the Bet the Board podcast. You, of course, can follow Dave Mason on Twitter at DaveMasonBOL. And Dave, we're down to the championship games, but before we get your take on the kind of action you've seen there, how did last weekend work out?
Real well. Wild card weekend was tough for us as we went over last week, but you know, everybody was riding those dogs, especially on the money line. So the four favorites winning outright was huge. I mean, the four biggest decisions were all the money lines. All the spread action was pretty even, you know, fit in the 50s, 55, 45, one side, 53, whatever. You know, it wasn't huge decisions on the spread, but the money lines are huge. One of the total, that total on the last game, the Saints game, that was the biggest total of the year, and 71% of the action was on the over. So we had a real good weekend. We bounced back. So wild card weekend went to the players. Divisional round went to Bet Online and bring on the championship games.
Dave, before we get to the championship games, just a quick question in terms of the action. We saw the Sunday games end really close apart. There was only like a handful of minutes. How does something like that impact the house in terms of overall bet count on a game like that?
Yeah, it sucks. I mean, it's, you know, so many players, you know, I mean, a lot of guys get their bets in early, but so many players just have, you know, bet their last amount of money on those the early games, and they wait to get graded and then double down or whatever on the late game. Or if they lose, they come back and deposit. And you know, I think there's like a 3.5-minute window between the early game and the late game. And it takes us about, on a high-volume game like that, it takes us about a minute to grade those big spread and total money line bets, which is very fast. So you take that minute away, now you're talking about what, like 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes to for people to get on and look at the odds and decide what they're going to bet, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, you do lose significant action. Probably lost about 10% of the action on that game, on the late game, maybe a little bit more, maybe 15% of the bets, or even up about 20% of action was lost on that late game. So it's unfortunate, you know, but there's nothing you can do. Hopefully next year they start the later games a little bit later.
And for conference championships, what does it look like right now for potential early liability?
Spread action, again, is 50-50. 51% of the early bettors are on the Rams, and 53% of the early bettors are on the Chiefs. Money line, that's going to be the big sweats again, without a doubt. And they're pounding the underdogs outright. Once again, 73% of the early bettors on the Rams, currently plus 148 outright, and 77% of the early bettors on the Patriots at plus 140 outright.
Anything sharp come in yet?
Yes, there is. Some sharps at Rams a few days ago, plus 3.5. They're currently getting a 3 points. And a little bit of action on the under. Pats Chiefs under 57, and we actually took a little bit of on the over too at 55.5, so that's currently 56. So we got a little two-way sharp action. Hopefully we don't get middle.
should be a great weekend of action. But Dave, you guys are always thinking one step ahead, and yesterday you guys did something pretty special at betonline.ag, the first book out there to hang futures, not for this year's Super Bowl obviously, but for the 2020 winner. You guys seen any action? We saw one of your tweets about the first bet you took was on a surprising team.
Yeah, right. We hung a Super Bowl 2020 odds yesterday, and the first bet was on the Cleveland Browns. I mean, if you follow my Twitter the last few years, the Browns are always a popular bet early on, and we're always exposed on them big time going into the season. And, you know, although it's only been 24 hours, they're already our biggest exposure. I just looked at their odds. They're down to 28-1. So they've moved from 33-1 to 28-1. So the early bettors are betting the Browns, our highest bet count. They're the first bet on the board. So, yeah, people have faith in the Browns again.
All aboard the Freddie Kitchens bandwagon. For a lot of our listeners out there that we know, a lot, most of them already play with you guys at betonline.ag, but should there be a few stragglers arriving late to the party to try and get some money down early, whether it be on the future, some of the Kyler Murray props you guys have, or, of course, the laundry list of Super Bowl propositions you guys will have available, what kind of sign-up codes and or bonuses are available for them?
Yes, sir. If you do not have a betonline.ag account, head on over to betonline.ag and sign up for one. Use promo code 75BTB on your first ever deposit to get a 75% bonus for the sports book. If you already have a betonline.ag account and have not used the Bet the Board Reload bonus yet, use promo code 50BTB for a one-time 50% reload bonus. Max bonus is $1,000. All the terms and conditions can be found at promotions.betonline.ag/bettheboard.
It's Dave Mason. You can hear him every single week with us here on the Bet the Board podcast. Dave, enjoy your bye week, my friend. Looking forward to chatting with you 2 weeks from today. And we have a much better idea, not only of the two combatants playing for the Super Bowl, but when you can share all of your insight and intel on the national anthem and what your favorite Maroon 5 song might be.
All right. I'll have to study up on that Maroon 5, but talk to you in 2 weeks.
I guess it's never a bad thing when the favorites all get to the window and then a potential chaser favorite, Payne, Sunday afternoon fails to cover because Will Lutz can't put a ball between the uprights from 50 yards out.
Yeah, that was interesting, right? As poorly as the Saints played, at least initially, and as well as Philly played initially, Saints still could have covered that game. I didn't see an edge there either. I made it 7.5, and a lot of these lines right now are tight. And of course, like, it's the NFL, like, there aren't going to be these massive discrepancies. You have to find a lot of underlying factors and some matchups which are going to be exploitable and give you an edge, but for the most part these lines are tight. But nice to hear Dave in a good mood, right? I think that's the big thing,
especially in the wake of the Eagles losing after the Alshon Jeffrey drop. But hey, I guess it's all perspective. You don't expect to get to that point of the season. Everything there on forward was a little bit of gravy, and as far as gravy's concerned around these fine parts, my friend, when we look at the weekend card, I mean, I know you've mentioned multiple times.
Not a
times
big gravy how, guy, by the way.
I'm not a huge gravy. What don't you guys call tomato sauce? Don't your people call tomato sauce gravy?
I think that's the fake Italians. I don't know. I don't call it gravy. It's sauce. Now, one of my guys calls it gravy, and he came out with a book. It's not sauce. It's gravy, so I don't want to. He listens to this podcast. But
yeah, I know you're pissing off all your people.
I don't call it gravy. I don't call it gravy. I'm a sauce guy. Okay.
All right, just wanted to check. So sauce, gravy, whatever the hell you want to call it. Best bets have been on a pretty good run up until we stubbed our toe a little bit with the Eagles Saints going over the total. How's the card looking this weekend?
It's ugly, and I hate doing this, obviously, and it comes at our own hindrance because we'll lose some listenership. But I don't want to give out anything that we haven't bet. And I've kind of hammered the table on this for the last 5 years. I don't want to get into the business of just giving out picks that I'm not invested in, and I don't have a single bet right now. We did it a couple times last season. We haven't done it at all this season, but you know, I think we need to at this point. What I'm going to advise is go to the website, bettheboard.net, bettheboardpodcast.com. There's a million different iterations. And go there. And you will see on the homepage, smack dab in the middle, a brand new podcast. It will be this podcast that you're listening to now. Click the button that says read more. At the bottom of that page, we will release...
I love
release,
the explicit directions, by the way.
Well, because people will ask, and I don't, I'm not a customer service department on game day, so I don't feel like responding to that kind of stuff. On game day, Sunday, January 20th, if you go to the website, click that, read more on the podcast, you will scroll to the bottom of that page, and there will be a best bet. Don't ask what time. I don't want the website to crash. It'll be before the first game starts. So check the website. It'll be there at the bottom of the podcast page. And that's where we'll be. And hopefully we get a winner. But I haven't bet anything. Have you bet anything at this point in this on the games?
I have not bet anything myself either in this particular game.
I don't want to go down that road of giving out shit that I haven't actually bet. So we'll wait till that happens. Hopefully it does happen, and when it does, we'll release it on the website.
All right, sounds like a plan. So we know where we'll be Sunday morning, waiting to try and see what our best bet is for championship weekend. But as we said time and time again, the name of the game around these parts isn't action. It's trying to give you winners, and we're never going to give something out that we actually haven't invested in ourselves. So keep that in mind. Make sure you come back and visit the site on Sunday to get up to the date. Up to the minute information. Anything else that you want to share with our listeners? iTunes contest, anything else that we have going on around these parts?
No, I do. We will have a couple contests for the Super Bowl. So get your 5-star reviews in. You'll automatically be entered. We'll be running another iTunes contest for the Super Bowl. And then there's one last thing. It'll be on social media, but we're going to run another Super Bowl contest as well. And we'll release those details on the Super Bowl podcast. So a couple of things in the works for our listeners, for sure.
Always a good way to finish the season. Man, time flies when you're having fun. Only one podcast to go. The Bet the Board Super Bowl Spectacular 2 weeks from now. And then we'll ultimately know who we're crowning the Super Bowl champion. So to all of you, our loyal listeners, thank you for all the feedback, interaction, 5-star reviews to iTunes that you guys have done to make this one of the most popular sports betting podcasts in the entire space. Special thanks to Dave Mason, who joins us every Thursday throughout the season. You, of course, can follow Dave on Twitter at Dave Mason BOL. Follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. You can follow me there as well. And of course, more importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. For Payne Insider, I'm Todd Furman. Best of luck this weekend with all of your championship investments on Sunday. And come, I don't know, Sunday night, we'll see you at the window.